Thursday. It's July 22nd, 2021. It's 1:38 in the afternoon. Hi, this is Sean Williams. You're listening to The Mincing Rascals. Thank you for that. And tell your friends to tune into The Mincing Rascals, too. You can hear me on WGN Radio weekdays from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune.
I'm Eric Zorn, Rascal at Large.
Oh, there you go. That works, Eric Zorn. Let's get started. Nice to see your face and hear your voice again, Lisa. We haven't seen or heard from you in a while, but we appreciate you always.
I've been hunkering down.
Being on the Mincing Rascals podcast. You're still working from home, aren't you?
I am still working from home, as you can see, yes. And I get to work from my living room today because my husband's out and about.
Are you productive that way? Are you as good in the living room or bedroom, if you'll pardon the expression, as you are, say, from the office?
Holy cow. I would say I have a little more balance. Like, okay, if I have a minute here, I could maybe sort of whip something up for dinner. Whereas I had to be a little bit more scheduled. But I am finding myself more and more wishing that, I don't know, that I was back in sort of this collaborative environment. And so I am looking forward to the day that we can be back in an office doing that, seeing each other. And
yeah,
what do you think that's going to look like, Lisa? I left the Tribune about a month ago, but it seemed clear to me that they have yet to really figure out what the office situation is going to be.
Right.
We moved from the Tribune Tower to the Prudential Center, mm-hmm. and now we've moved to the Freedom Center printing plant. You have moved there. But I guess they're like hoteling the desks and stuff so that you won't actually have your own desk. You'll have to reserve a spot.
I'm told I actually have a desk with my name on it there. I don't know if it's going to look like a WeWork office where just a bunch of people sort of show up now and again, or maybe it never will look sort of the same, where you have this office area where you have a bunch of editors grouped in one area, you know, reporters in their messy desks filled with fast food bags and reports and people just sort of milling about and it sort of being this kind of energized.
That's a good thing. That's all a good thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of people talking to probably attorneys and HR about what this looks like because they don't want to be sued if the workplace becomes a super spreader.
What about you, Austin? Are you still at home?
I've been back in probably 3 times a week, which I think is where I'll settle out. It's been awesome. We have a desk reservee type of system, too. People are vaccinated. People are in. You get to see their faces.
I have my office, and I haven't lost my office. And everybody who has a workstation or desk or place or cubicle has all retained them here at WGN. It would be very weird to me to come back and have the environment different like that. I would not like to not be bumping into our editors and news writers and producers in the halls here.
Is it a trade secret, John, that are some of the hosts broadcast remotely, right? Is that?
Yeah. No, that's not secret, although, you know, sometimes you don't like to advertise the fact either. But for the beginning of the pandemic, I think it was just me and Bob Surratt were the only ones that were in. So mornings to noon or 1. But from 1 to the next day at 5 a.m., we were remote. Let's talk about Lollapalooza to start this week's podcast. 1 week from today, the city says be careful, but go to the 100% capacity, 100,000-person-a-day, 4-day music festival. The music fest is an almost perfect distillation of what we've been doing for the last almost year and a half. The economic value to the city and the merchants is colliding with the medical risks. There's some distrust out there of the medical authority. There's fatigue. The city in 2019 made around $5 million off Lollapalooza. But more important than that is the idea that it is safe and fun to come downtown. Canceling Lollapalooza would send an expensive message to businesses and event planners, the city and people in general. It's not just about the money that we will make or lose off Lollapalooza this year. It's about what comes afterwards. If you had to decide, let's start with you, Austin, what would you say the event planners should do for Lollapalooza?
Who's the lineup again?
I got that message. They said cancel it, not because of COVID, but because of the lame lineup this year.
Limp Bizkit.
Yeah.
It's an all-Limp Bizkit festival.
Yeah.
I would definitely keep it on. I believe the governor has said he's going to go, so it seems like they have political backing. And it's outside. We had lots of people, young people especially, outside. I was one of them downtown in the height of the pandemic protesting. And I think you can do it safely when people are outside. I'm not sure what the masking protocol is. I would guess that masks are not required when you go in. But it will be the first time in my life I will say I will be happy to see a lot of drunk high schoolers coming out of Union Station and walking over to Grant Park during Lollapalooza this year.
Where are you on this, Lisa?
I'm wondering if they should expand the perimeter of this thing, although Lollapalooza has already taken up a lot of time and space on taxpayer-funded land. I think it's of concern. And I will say, I think people kind of protesting for civil rights versus a big corporate booze fest, I think people could probably sort of make an argument that one is more important than the other. However, yes, the governor did say today that he is going with the First Lady and their friends. So I write about that for the politics newsletter that I just turned in before jumping on the show here, that it is endorsed. That seems like an endorsement from the governor for sure.
And the mayor.
And that it's time to go. I also listened to the city's top public health doctor, Allison Arwady, her briefing today, and she capped it off. I'm still thinking about it. This is sort of like an hour or so ago. She said, no, go. If you're in the mosh pit, put on a mask. But then at the end of the conversation, she said, you know, at some point, COVID is something that we're going to have to live with. You know, hurt businesses.
It's mixed signals, that's for sure.
Well, let's be honest. If we had known 6 months ago that we were going to have that the current state of the new variant and that the virus was going to be as running rampant as it is right now, which is not to say it's as bad as it was, but that if we had known then what we know now, we would not only cancel Lollapalooza, we would cancel the Olympics. I think we're seeing a version here in Chicago, a small version of what they're seeing in Tokyo, which is that in hindsight, if they had known it was going to be this bad, they would not have been holding the Olympics. They would not be holding Lollapalooza. And so this is essentially a financial decision, not a public health decision that's being made. And I guess we have to realize that we do live in an economy. We do have a situation where there would be a lot of people out a lot of money, and that causes real pain to people. So we have to realize that. I would, if I were the czar of these events, certainly of Lollapalooza, I would drastically limit the attendance. I would make it so that you could make it possible for people to stay apart from each other. I heard Jim DeRogatis yesterday on John Williams' radio show, and he is a huge rock fan, much bigger fan of what's going on at Lollapalooza.
He's not a big Lollapalooza fan.
No, he's not a big fan of Lolla. No, he's
but
not.
He's a guy who's really into this kind of music, and he was just vehement.
Yeah.
About this being a really bad idea. John actually had to cut him off, as I recall.
I know. He wouldn't stop. I'm like,
we get some bills to pay here, Mr. DeRogatis. But I really think that there is an argument to be made for limiting the attendance. Now, of course, even making that argument now, all the tickets have been sold. What are you going to do? Say half the ticket? Mm-hmm. If you've got an even numbered ticket, you can't come. You can't do it. This is a situation with a ton of momentum, financial momentum and everything else. And I don't see any way of stopping it. But I agree with Jim, and I agree with my former colleague Rex Hupke at the Tribune that this has all the earmarks of a super spreader event. And we're going to look back on it and go, wow, we were almost out of this COVID nightmare. And it won't be the only event, obviously, that did this, but that we got too casual. We relaxed and it came roaring back.
There have been warnings from everybody from Fauci to Dr. Arwady and public health officials in between. We always knew there was going to be a variant, and they were here even when the mayor decided. This was May when she had decided, well, let's do this thing. Let's have Lollapalooza this year. The numbers are still low, but they're climbing up again. And so the mayor was asked this week, do you regret this decision now? And she said, no.
Could she have said, is this a possible answer, Lisa? Yeah, I do regret the decision, but the momentum and the money are there. And it's not like we don't have a vaccine. Yeah, I'm sorry that we're in this place right now, but I'm still going to say go. Just be as careful as you can.
I don't think the mayor is going to say that, though.
Dr. Arwady was implicated in that decision as well, because she was co-starred in that really odd announcement video that the mayor put out, and basically giving it her like scientific stamp of approval. To the small business point, there was a real, this kind of got overlooked, but Pritzker did all of these interviews yesterday and the day, or day before yesterday. And somebody asked, a reporter asked him about his regrets. I believe it was Mike Flannery at Fox 32. And he said one of them was small business shutdowns. And when people were going to Walmart and being able to buy other items that they could have bought at, because Walmart sold groceries, he said that that was a regret. I haven't seen that covered that much, but that's a very big decision. And he should regret that decision.
You're saying because Walmart was allowed to be open under certain restrictions, because they sold groceries, you had stores that sold other sort of goods that were sold elsewhere in Walmart that people were having, were then going to Walmart to buy rather than these other stores. Is that
right? Deeming businesses. Deeming essential and non-essential businesses. Exactly.
Well, I think Eric's got a fair point that if they knew then what they know now, they wouldn't do it. But they don't have that luxury, Eric. And don't you think there's something to my concern that if you shut down Lollapalooza, you lose, you shut down more than Lollapalooza. I mean, they're closing State Street on Sundays to try and get people to come downtown. And they're even going to do that to Michigan Avenue. Tonight, they're going to close a block of Michigan Avenue. It's like Peoria Fest. Come on down. We're going to have music and beers. And this is the Mag Mile I'm talking about. So that's how desperate they are to get people back downtown. And if you cancel Lollapalooza for whatever reason, and it's not going to be the concern for the violence, although that's what's keeping people away. But if you cancel Lollapalooza, I think that's tough.
I think you're exactly right, John. I think that when you're looking at a situation like this and you're trying to balance out all the various interests and all the problems, that you can't just say, oh, well, it's more important for us to keep the people who are basically the ones who are not vaccinated. They're the ones who are probably going to end up in the hospital. There are breakthrough cases, obviously. But if you've been vaccinated, if you followed the science and you've been vaccinated, you're probably not going to end up in the hospital, and you're almost certainly not going to end up dead. If you have not been vaccinated, you may well end up in the hospital, and you might end up dead. So in a sense, to close down Lollapalooza in order to protect the people who are too stupid to get a vaccine is galling. And it's not, as you point out, it's not a zero cost thing. You've got businesses that are really relying on this. You've got a whole downtown economy that's relying on this. And people involved in that actually do, they suffer, and they suffer in very real, very tangible ways. So it isn't a very easy thing like, well, we don't want anyone to get sick, so we're not going to have Lollapalooza. If that was your standard, you wouldn't ever have anything like Lollapalooza because people are going to get sick.
Well, so
we also forget in this that there's lots of local governments looking forward to cash trap, local governments looking forward to the tax dollars that roll in from this.
I think people are so afraid to come downtown Chicago. I read it on my text line all the time. Good Lord, that party bus got shot up in Lincoln Park last night on a Wednesday night. That was bizarre. We had three mass shootings today, right? I think that's what they're calling it. Three mass shootings, multiple people shot today on a Wednesday.
John, what was the story behind the party bus? Who was shooting it up and why? Was it a totally random event, or was it targeted?
It was at Clark and LaSalle.
It was right in my old neighborhood.
And that's a nice area. I ride my bike past there all the time. Late at night, a party bus is pulled over, and I don't think we know many of the details. There were a lot of people on the bus. Eight people were shot. At least one of them may not survive. Were they targeted, or was it random? I don't know that as of this moment. Speaking of policing, at least we have a civilian oversight of the Chicago Police Department now, so none of these things will happen again. On Twitter this week, Austin Berg said, instead of aggressively tackling the consent decree and getting the mayor out of police politics, Chicago gets 73 new political officials in parallel with existing oversight body. So that's your no-confidence vote for their potential no-confidence votes, Austin, is that right?
Yeah, and I'm not going to begrudge anyone for, you know, running for their local police council. But I think the standard is if you have to spend more than a couple minutes explaining to the average person how this oversight body even functions, how it's elected, who's elected, when, what authority they have, it's not going to be an effective voice for real community input. And I think that's the real risk here, is that it becomes a political sideshow, not a slideshow, a sideshow.
Yeah, maybe a slideshow.
And maybe there definitely will be slideshows involved. But there are these 22, just to get everybody up to speed, the new ordinance establishes elected councils in each of the 22 police districts. So if you're in your police district, you will elect three people to a board. One of those people will be selected to serve on a nominating commission. The person on the nominating commission will send commission members to the mayor's office. The mayor will vote up or down on these members of the commission. The commission is a different 7-member body that has the power to do things like request documents or testimony from the police department. They can put forth advisory opinions. They can pass things over to city council to pass. But in and of itself, it does not have the power to do really any policy making. And is essentially just this enormous new political body on top of COPA, on top of internal affairs, on top of the inspector general's office, that I think ultimately is not going to move the ball forward very much when it comes to the most important things about professionalizing the police department.
And ultimately instilling trust between the community and the police department. I think they think that creating this bureaucratic organization is going to do that. But I question whether the details of it and the authority is going to be lost.
Well, Austin, I heard you interviewed on John Williams' radio program this week also about this.
Thank you for dialing in.
It's where I get all my news.
What are you, retired?
And my takeaway from this, from your description, from every story I've read about this, is that this is one of the most toothless, quote-unquote, reforms that I have ever seen. And it baffles me that everybody seems to be celebrating it. It's like the mayor's people are saying that this is, you know, the great step forward, and even some of the reformers are saying that this is an advance. This is basically an advisory panel, mm-hmm. and they can recommend things, and the mayor can say, no. And I guess in some cases there are some ways that a supermajority of the city council can overrule the mayor, but that's a very rare thing to happen, and it would be emblematic of a huge bit of political dysfunction that we're not seeing right now in the area of policing. So I don't understand, why is this getting so much? Why is everybody patting themselves on the back over this? I don't get it.
Because so many council members and the mayor were elected on a platform of police reform. So it's in everyone's interest to say, wow, this is the most progressive policing reform, which it's not. It's not the most progressive policing reform. It is unlike anything in the country, but not in a good way. It's freakish. It's total. No one else has this. It's really, really crazy. And I think it's going to be a total sideshow.
One of the things I'm interested in is because there are a fair number of journalists saying it's historic. It's historic in that Chicago has something now, which is better than nothing, I guess, is the take.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to be careful of that, because if you look at Oakland, California, for instance, that oversight, that civilian body has the right to fire the police chief, and in fact did fire the police chief, who was a candidate, one of Mayor Lightfoot's shortlist to be police superintendent here. Now, that was a different political battle. I don't know that I'm not getting into sort of whether she should have been a finalist here or not. That's not my point. The point is that is historic. That is civilian oversight. It's a different thing. It's changed the community a lot, and it's changed the relationship between the community and police. Not to say that there aren't still problems, but that is sort of viewed as historic and really what true civilian oversight looks like.
You know, what I was reminded of was the idea of a school board in which some minority faction is elected and the rest of them are appointed by the mayor, so that you have sort of this group of people who are serving essentially in an advisory capacity along with a majority of people who answer to the mayor. In this case, you've just got a panel that serves as a super advisory panel, but that doesn't have any power. And yes, Austin says there's nothing like this in the country, but there are places where there is more and better civilian oversight, and perhaps that would be called for here. But the idea, and again, if this is all they can do, then fine. But everyone seems to be celebrating it, and I just don't get it.
There's a difference between like civilian and professional oversight, and what this is going to turn out to be is a platform for some of the most radical views about what police should or shouldn't do in the city, and ultimately worsen relationships. What's going to improve community police relationships is better policing. And guess what? We got a 250-page plan that goes down the line and says, make these reforms that will improve your police department. So
that's the consent decree.
That's the consent decree. Yeah. And I think another thing last year is another reason it's really annoying. A lot of people in city council are patting themselves on the back is that you wouldn't need this body if city council did its job. We have a public safety committee that has all these powers, but if you were going to hold the police accountable in city council, that means holding the mayor accountable, and the mayor appoints the chair of committees. So instead of actually having city council do its job as police oversight, putting forth police policy, they've created a whole new body that's even bigger than our huge city council to address these things. And I do not have high hopes.
It sounds like a student council because, you know, it's advisory, yes. It's local, it's elected.
And the principal, do a better job of creating
and the principal goes, yeah, no, we're not going to do that.
But it's like, John, it's like student council where you, as I understand this, as Austin describes it, is like we'll elect three people,
yes,
to be on the student council. And then from those people, there'll be some other people. And then the principal will select among those people who gets to be on this advisory board.
Right.
It is just such a strange contraption.
And then we'll ignore
again,
it.
Who's going to be running for these positions? How are they going to campaign? Where's that? Any political campaign, anybody who's running for any office, what kind of turnout is there going to be? How informed will the electorate be? How much is money going to influence who is going to be on these
panels?
Well,
Eric, I don't even care what the answers to those questions are. What I care about is how do we stop the shootings on the streets? How do we make the city safer?
Right.
If this helps do that, hooray. I'm not sure that a good version of this helps do that. I mean, because it sounds like a better version of this, you could throw the police superintendent out. I don't know what a new police superintendent's going to do.
The idea behind the reason people are focused on that is it's some kind of leverage to force reforms in the department. Like, hey, if you're the superintendent and you're not making this stuff happen that we've all agreed and the consent decree has to happen, you're out. So like in Los Angeles, their police commission is 5 members. They're appointed by the mayor, but very difficult to remove. And they can vote to remove the police superintendent. The mayor can appoint the superintendent with a vote of city council, but they can vote to remove. And that is an important, you know, function. But that obviously in this proposal is not changed. And there is no policymaking authority for this board. So what's going to end up happening is you'll have 22 of these local councils. We'll have monthly meetings where people get up and yell at the police. And then we'll say, OK, great. Now the community has a voice in policing, but they can't actually change anything. They're just going to be yelling at police. So, yeah, sorry to be a Debbie Downer about the police proposal, because I'm really mad about it because it's such a wasted opportunity. This was a platform so many people were elected on. But we see this throughout Chicago history, like every 10 to 20 years, there's a new police oversight body and it continues to fail.
The schools have largely opted to get rid of their we talked about this last week, but that story moves forward a little bit. There aren't going to be as many police officers in the schools. The schools are going to spend the money some other way. Right, Eric?
Well, if you do the math, it looks like among the Chicago public high schools, in the last 2 years, counting this year's change, they've gotten rid of about half of their school resource officers, the police officers who were there. So some schools got rid of both. A bunch of schools kept, I think like 24 schools kept one officer, mm-hmm, and maybe another 20 or so got rid of both, and the rest kept their officers. So it's sort of a mixed verdict. And as I observed last week, it seems like when you're looking at which schools are getting rid of their officers, they tend to be the schools that are maybe in lower crime areas or have lower incidence of student disciplinary problems. So you may not be addressing the problem that a lot of people are worried about with police and schools, which is the schools to prison pipeline that happens when you put young school miscreants and other bullies and fighters and so on into the justice system rather than into the school discipline system.
And it's also interesting this week to note that CPS still doesn't have a vaccine mask plan for classes which start in 5 weeks. A lot of the other schools in the suburbs are ignoring the CDC guidelines and the American Association of Pediatrics, and they're saying that you don't have to be vaccinated to go back to school, and you don't have to wear a mask even when you go back to school. So CPS is still on the
sidelines. Cognitive dissonance on especially that American Academy of Pediatrics, because they were out early saying you need in-person schooling. And of course, all the same people now saying no masks said, look, the American Academy of Pediatrics said you got to have in-person schooling. And now everybody's going back and citing the same expert that they either previously denounced or accepted in the roles of reversed.
I didn't notice that. I wonder why they flipped on that a little bit, Austin.
Well, they didn't flip on it. They said you have to. The health consequences of kids being out of school are really severe. You need to have as much in-person learning as possible, masked, distanced, et cetera.
Oh, I see.
Now they're saying you should have masks. But again, it's people choose their sources on that stuff.
Yeah.
It does. Again, it seems to me like one of those situations that calls for compromise. It calls for students who are not vaccinated or all students. Let's say all students and faculty should wear masks in the hallways and maybe in the classroom, too. I wouldn't presume to know how to advise these schools about this. But that certainly there are places around the country where governors have issued edicts saying that schools cannot have mask mandates. And I think this is just churlish behavior at some point. It is all political.
Because
you ought to leave this up to the health officials and people who know what they're talking about and not governors.
Well, look at that Barrington school board meeting where it was a very vocal group of people, maybe in the minority, and they just kind of forced their will on the school board. You know, the president of the school superintendent there, he's not a medical doctor, but he's got a PhD. He's an educated man. He knows what the CDC says. He knows what the IDPH wants. And yet, you know, everybody was yelling and screaming and pointing their fingers at those guys. And so they said, okay, sixth grade through high school does not have to wear a mask and does not have to be vaccinated. It's amazing to me that they are ignoring what the medical professionals are telling them. And I think they're doing it at the behest of these angry, yelling parents that show up at these meetings. They're being badgered into it. Maybe not bullied, but badgered into, I think, decisions they know are not in the best interest of the kids. In sports, Ben Zobrist and Juliana Zobrist's divorce continues to play out. And boy, we picked up a few new details since our last podcast. Just for instance, in the last year of his contract, he was supposed to make $12 million. This was in 2019, the last year of his contract. But he was so torn by the divorce proceedings. His wife was having an affair with their counselor slash pastor. And so Ben Zobrist didn't play much baseball that year. He forfeited $8 million in pay. Now, he made about $75 million over the course of his career. She wants the money split 50-50. He wants it to be split 60-40. But since that one last year, he didn't make $8 million as he was dealing with this. She says, wait a minute, I should be getting the $4 million that you didn't earn because you weren't working. You owe me $4 million that you should have earned by playing baseball. That's good lawyering. That's somebody really thinking out of the box.
I can't imagine that a family court judge wouldn't laugh that claim right out, but it might be a negotiating ploy on her part because it's absurd and it makes her look terrible. I don't think she looks very good in this arrangement as it is right now. The allegation that she was having an affair with their pastor slash counselor, she looks like she's the one who is driving the wedge into their marriage. On the other hand, she accuses him of inappropriate marital conduct as well.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, there were just lots of great detail. We had a very long story, or they had a very long story in the Tribune. You have to excuse me for continuing to say we about the Tribune for a while, but the Tribune had a really good long story about all the details in that divorce filing. And boy, that was one dysfunctional relationship. And again, the thing that draws my attention to it was how they were so pious. You know, they were always pointing up at the sky and, you know, we're so religious and she's a religious singer. And meanwhile, all this sordid stuff is going on in the background. It reminds me a little of this allegation that just surfaced recently about the high official in the Catholic Church in the United States who was somehow someone did some electronic surveillance and found out that he was frequenting gay bars and was using Grindr, I think it was, a gay app. And so he had to resign over that. It's like it's not so much the activity. It's a lot of it's kind of ordinary, but it's the hypocrisy that you see that draws one's attention in stories like this.
The Peoria Journal Star had actually pretty good reporting on it, too. And I don't know why the same day I read the story in the Tribune, I saw even more details in the Peoria newspaper. But they said that at his retirement party, the pastor's retirement party, she went ahead and took $30,000 of their assets, money, to spend on a party. And he evidently wasn't aware of where all the money was going. So he finds out that $30,000 of his money went to pay for this guy's swan song. And at that party, the reporting was that she and the pastor got drunk and were dancing lewdly in front of the family, friends, and kids. Knowing that any of that was going to come out and that they have children is inexplicable to me.
Put in a brief plug for Righteous Gemstones, which this would be a storyline in the show Righteous Gemstones, evangelical family acting badly, like televangelists. And this guy, this pastor, Jan, looks like he would be in this show.
What's
this?
Is that like a Netflix series that I missed?
It's on HBO. It stars, Kenny Powers. Who plays Kenny Powers? Danny McBride.
John, you make a good point, though, about knowing that all this information is going to be in the public record and you've got children who you want to protect from some of these allegations. You would think that a pair of adults and their lawyers could get together and settle all this without all this information coming out in public for people like us to talk about.
And not only is it harmful to the kids, it's not good for either of their careers. Like, I don't know what his second chapter in the baseball world is going to be. Does he want to be a manager or a broadcaster? Maybe he can survive that, but it doesn't seem to help her career. You know, even if she bats it back and wins and they say, well, it's not true, he was just lying, that stuff sticks and it has the patina of truth. I'm willing to believe that stuff really happens. So I don't see how she thinks this is a, like, okay, what if he does give you the $4 million that he didn't earn? How does that help you, really? You've already got $20 million from him. What you want is a career, and this is a career killer. Speaking of the rich and famous, what is your take on the billionaire space program? We've had three of them go up and come down safely.
I was thankful that somebody else was spending their money generating all that technology and research and jobs, and it wasn't me, because the same thing happened with air travel and with televisions and with refrigeration. And all these things are only the domain of the super duper rich for a little bit, for a transition period where they work out the kinks. And they're the people who have to take the like 15-hour transatlantic flights from New York to London when air travel first started. And, so that I today in 2020, one can have a 7-hour flight and it is really, really safe. So I didn't understand really, like, of course, any sort of like display of wealth generates a lot of negative feelings with people, but these things, this is a great use of someone's wealth. Like they're generating new research. NASA famously talks about how many offshoot new technologies that improve the world came from their research. And the same will happen with all of this. And I think it's great because I want to go see space too. And I don't want to have to pay for it with my tax money. I'd rather someone else pay for it.
I wonder if it were somebody else who were leading the charge then, not a Jeff Bezos, for instance, he was the latest, if we would be more amenable to that, if we would hear that, if we would have thought of that more, because that didn't get sold. It was mostly, this is a vanity project. They're off the ground for 11 minutes. You know, they floated in space for a minute or three, and that was the end of it. So this really isn't earth-shattering or groundbreaking. It didn't seem that way.
Yeah, you don't want to be the person who is equivalent to the person 100 years ago who was scoffing at air travel or at motor cars and things like that. Yeah. You don't want to be that person. On the other hand, this did look a lot like a thrill ride. Like these guys went up and it was 11 minutes or so, and then they came back down again. And maybe in 10 years, you can do it for $50,000 or $20,000 even. It's still just going to be a thrill ride. I don't think we're talking about, well, this is just the first step into going to the moon, because I don't think we're ever going to really want to go to the moon.
No, but it's the first step to going to Tokyo or Sydney, right? I mean, that's the commercialization of these rockets, isn't it, Eric, that you'll fly around the world faster?
Is that what it could be? I mean, like I'm saying, I don't want someone to play this podcast in 100 years after it's archived in the museums where it belongs, where they say, well, here he was scoffing at this technology. You know, people who scoffed about the internet and people who scoffed about cars and planes and so on.
I hope this does go somewhere for posterity, because I do want to scoff at a bunch of rich people who are blasting off to space so that they can come back and high five their other white guy buddies. It's like half of the planet is suffering because they don't have enough water and food. I mean, I'm sorry. I just can't get past it.
What does that have to do with it? What is that?
I saw on MSNBC cheerleading like that this was somehow a replacement for NASA. When this, to me, it doesn't seem like it's anything of the sort or anything close to that. Nobody's scoffing at the idea of like, oh, it would be cool to go up and into space and to see that. No, nobody's saying that. I think the concern here is sort of what it represents. And you're seeing sort of about three of those guys represent what, a third of the wealth in the world. I mean, it's, I don't know. I can't get past it. And I had to turn it off at some point.
That was one of the conversations we had here, Lisa, was maybe Austin's right. The technology is better.
Oh, I don't disagree. I don't disagree with some of that. Yeah, there could be. It's just not. That's not what these guys are after. They're after sort of they're showboaters all the way. They're not. I don't believe that any of them are interested in the technology. I believe probably some of the people working for them are marginally, but no.
Well, I was just a little surprised by the media coverage of it because they were. You know, they were doing the commercial for Amazon. They were the ones that were giving him the platform and not I didn't hear a lot of, you know, critical analysis of or criticism of what I thought was a vanity project, a thrill ride, like Eric said. Maybe I should think more about the technology, Austin, that's going to spin out of this. And hey, if you can get to Tokyo in 2 hours from Chicago, that may be a viable business thing. But boy, the media was all over that. Maybe because they were waiting to see if the thing crashed. But then they cover the press conference when he lands, and he thanks his customers.
I like the person who said that now Jeff Bezos knows how his employees feel when they have to pee into a bottle.
Bette Midler had a couple of good lines. This one wasn't one of them, but they said they were in space for 10 minutes or what Amazon calls maternity leave. And there's a bunch. I mean, you know, he can take it. You got that coming. Bette Midler was the one, I think, who said his rocket took him up into space and ironically landed him at the wrong address, delivered him to the wrong address.
I think it's just interesting. Like, if NASA did the same thing, I wouldn't really care about what their motives were. There would still be like a lot of good that came out of it.
Yeah.
And if they showboat, like the Wright brothers showboated too, you know, they took a bunch of risks and put their names on the line to do this crazy experiment. And here I am getting to like sit in this like pretty cozy life and benefit from their stuff decades later. So I think it's pretty good. Even if they are like, I'm not trying to hang out with Jeff Bezos, you know. I'm not saying he's the best person ever, but well, I think it's really cool.
If that were Tom Hanks in that rocket ship, then I would feel differently about it. Like, I love Tom Hanks, but I don't love Jeff Bezos, which is that's a stupid way to evaluate this. So fair enough.
So those listening to this at the Smithsonian in the listening room, 100 years from now in the year 2121, Austin Berg. B-E-R-G.
Yes, right. Yeah. Told us.
Lisa Donovan, later crowned queen of the United States.
Well, but again, I think really what is the purpose of this? They're not going to go to Mars. And if you have a lot of money and you want to go up and go, hey, I'm floating in space and now I'm coming down and that's worth $2 million to you. I guess
some of the rockets, though, I should say, like to the positive externalities of this, some of the technological application is getting better satellites for underserved areas of the world to get internet access. And that's a huge benefit, too, if the cost of that is even diminished a little bit.
Would have helped, too, if the spaceship didn't look like something out of Austin Powers. You know, I mean, we just got distracted by how much fun it was to rip on this thing, and I haven't had a sufficient appreciation of the science or opportunities of this thing. So thank you, Austin, and to those of you listening to us at the Smithsonian. Did you pay much attention to the Fauci disagreement with Rand Paul?
Dr. Fauci, knowing that it is a crime to lie to Congress, do you wish to retract your statement of May 11th where you claimed that the NIH never funded gain-of-function research in Wuhan?
Senator Paul, I have never lied before the Congress, and I do not retract that statement.
I think it was a hearing specifically on masks, I want to say. even though that line of questioning didn't have anything to do with masks. I could be wrong.
So what was, let me finish.
You take an animal virus and you increase its transmissibility to humans,
right.
You're saying that's not gain of function?
Yeah, that is correct. And Senator Paul, you do not know what you are talking about, quite frankly. And I want to say that officially.
Not that he needs me to defend him. I hate to see Fauci come under criticism like that, particularly when they say things like, well, the science was wrong then. The science was never wrong. Our understanding of the science is better now than it was, but the science wasn't wrong. But the two of them squaring off was good theater, if nothing else.
It really was. Fauci, I think that was felt like 16 months of pent-up anger. He is, after all, a member of Biden's cabinet for all intents and purposes as leading the response to the pandemic. And that's a rarity. You just don't see that. Usually it's sort of like, okay, I'll take my lumps. I think he's taken a few lumps over the months under the Trump administration, sort of taking heat from lawmakers and now. But I think under Biden, he feels probably more comfortable firing back.
Well, because the president isn't going to give him the sack if he openly disagrees with her. I mean, Rand Paul, to my mind, is a cartoon character. And his spinning out his paranoid theories and confronting Fauci with them, I thought he looked really, really bad, really stupid. And I thought Fauci handled him quite well. It actually makes me think it's not the same topic exactly, but the January 6th panel that was appointed, it's not a topic, it was on our list, but that how Minority Leader McCarthy has decided that the Republicans he's not going to allow any Republicans to participate in the House investigation of the January 6th insurrection because he wouldn't allow Jim Jordan, and Speaker Pelosi wouldn't allow Jim Jordan and some of the other hotheads on that panel. So I guess Liz Cheney is going to be there, is going to be the only Republican on that panel. They're going to try to portray as simply a partisan investigation.
Well, should you exclude the people that don't believe that Joe Biden is the duly elected president of the United States, or we're questioning that? I mean, should they be on that panel?
Well, and McCarthy has given his list now over to Pelosi of several people, and now that seems to be changing. I have gotten word that Adam Kinzinger would probably be palatable to Pelosi. Of course, he is a Republican. He's from south of the suburbs here in Chicago. He's a Republican, a conservative Republican, but somebody who has been very critical of Trump. If he gets on the panel, that'll be interesting.
I think John's question is a good one, which is, do you want to allow the Republicans to put whoever they want on this panel and let them try to turn it into a sideshow?
They're not going to be able to. Pelosi has to okay it. She has the final word on it.
Right, but I think the question is it smart for Pelosi to tell the Republicans who they can and can't have on this panel, even though you're talking about these people like Jim Jordan, who is a hothead and a dishonest broker, who would threaten to turn the whole thing into a sideshow either way? Do you just go ahead and say, okay, he's on, and we'll let the American public watch and let them judge and see whether these people are credible, whether they've got a case to make? Just bring this subject out. I think, as distasteful as I find people like Jordan, I think it's politically not very smart to keep to make it look like you're going to do the job that the Senate House Minority Leader is empowered to do, which is to put his people on that panel.
Right. But I think that what I'm saying is it sounds like they're negotiating that list. If you have Jim Jordan, then you put, a Kinzinger on there who is a Republican, but is a huge Trump critic.
It makes you wonder what the purpose of the panel is, or what the purpose of having a Jim Jordan is on there. Is he going to change his mind? You can see him doing in a hearing what maybe Paul did to Fauci. They're not looking for information. They're just arguing and making their case. You know what that's going to look like. It's not going to be productive.
It does make the Democrats appear to be afraid of what Jordan has said. I don't think they are. I think they just don't want to give him a bigger platform for it. They're in a tough spot. I think the Republicans have maneuvered them into this tough spot where they're either going to look like they're highly partisan, or they're going to open up this hearing to all kinds of subject areas that they don't really want to. They want to focus it on what happened on January 6th.
And one last thing, we are, you know, that Jefferson guy I put on stage, we're going to do another show at the Tivoli Theater in Downers Grove. And he's going to come on as Jefferson.
It's a great theater.
I love it. We've done the show there before, and so we're going to do the show there again. The last show we did was there in 2019, so we're going back. Anyway, I'm thinking about doing like a 30-minute Mincing Rascals live on stage there in front of that crowd. Yeah, October 30th.
As a warm-up act?
Yeah, we'd be the warm-up act.
I think that's fine. Well, it's true, but I just put it in my calendar. I'll be in the audience heckling. Thanks, John.
Right. See you guys.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.